Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week, we try to go through the annals of history and find you some interesting facts that happened on this week in music history. And of course, along with me is my co-host, Jacob Grum.
You never fail to aggrandize what we do.
I like to do fun intros, and that's just what I do. So you leave me alone.
Oh, I'm going to let you fly off the handles because it feels like it's been forever.
It has been forever since we've been in studio together. We backlogged a bunch of stuff before, so we've just sort of been pacing it out. And, you know, just life gets in the way sometimes. So we actually haven't been in studio in 2 weeks. And, you know, but we're still having ourselves a grand old time. Greg Harvey is, of course, out tonight. He is working hard for the money because, you know, we got to treat him right.
It's high for the water.
So, but this week in music history, of course, on Follow the Sound, it's one of our favorite things to do, one of our favorite things to do for episodes. But before we get into our actual history of July 17th through July 21st, just say if you enjoy our podcast, of course, you can check out other great podcasts on lineupmedia.fm. Just fantastic shows that people enjoy. I know because I get to see the download numbers, and so I see the shows that everybody is actually listening to. And you guys are fantastic fans going out there and just listening to all of our great programming on lineupmedia.fm. And also, if you'd like to help out our podcast, you can go to any of our social media stuff. We're on Facebook. You can find us at Follow the Sound podcast on Facebook. Or you can go to Twitter at iFollowTheSound. Or if you want to help us out with a little bit of financial stuff, you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com, click on the Amazon banner on the right-hand side, or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Takes you to Amazon. You can do all of your normal shopping. It won't cost you anything extra, and we get a little bit of money for all of the purchases that you make on the site. It's that simple. And it's just super, super easy. And we've got a video showing you exactly how to do that on our Facebook page right now if you want to go and check that out. But please find us on Facebook and Twitter because we love interacting with the people on social media. And, you know, we have fun with that. We want to know what you guys think about the show. So go ahead and let us know. Unless it's negative, keep that to yourself. I'm kidding. We can handle criticism. But let's get into music history. Jake, kick off this fantastic week.
All right, here we go. On this day in July 17th, 1939, Charlie Barnett took to the studio and recorded Cherokee, a composition composed by Ray Noble a year previously, but the version recorded by Chuck took on a life of its own, and in addition to being commercial success, is still incredibly influential in jazz music and still referenced constantly.
So this isn't Cherokee People.
No,
okay,
not
no.
That Cherokee.
It's not that song.
No,
no, it's a complete. I know exactly what song you're talking about because I of course am a fan of the song,
yes.
Cherokee. But as you and I both, though,
yes.
We are both fans of different versions than this version.
Yes, the Buddy Rich version is
the Buddy
is
Rich
my personal
version
favorite.
Is better. It's just that simple.
Well, I'm not going to say it's a better arrangement because the Charlie Barnett one was supposed to be the middle piece of a 4-piece arrangement.
Ah,
Cherokee, Comanche, and two other tribal names that I can't remember right now off the top of my head.
No one ever writes songs about Cahokia, though.
Well, there's a reason for that, Brian.
Nobody cares.
No, it's that we don't know who they were.
That's true. That is also
when
true.
You have a site that's named after the closest people who were there at the time when you found the site.
Yeah.
You're kind of stretching thin for what was really going on. But anyway.
Sorry, we live in St. Louis or roundabouts there, and near us is Cahokia Mounds, which was actually like the largest settlement in North America,
yes,
for like a good long while, and then they all just vanished, and nobody really knows what happened. Like, they must have died off or separated or did something. And then when explorers showed up, they found a group of Native Americans here who called themselves the Cahokia, but those people weren't the people who were there before.
No.
They called those people the Mound Builders.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, there's this big giant mound, though, that we call Cahokia Mound, and it's like just this huge.
Well, the name
thing.
Of the mound, it said the largest mound, it's Monk's Mound.
Yes.
Because there was a Trappist monk's abbey on top of it at one time.
Yes. So there you go.
So there you go.
There's
but,
your
yeah.
weird non-music history for yes. the day.
And there are many theories as there are archaeological papers.
Yes, that is true. That
on
is very
the
true.
Site.
Very,
anyhow.
Very true. But yes, we are both fans of the Buddy Rich version just because it's you know, a great little tune. And I like the Buddy Rich version just because it's faster and smoother, in my opinion. But
all right, we got a birthday.
Go. Give me the birthday.
Here we go. Current St. Louis resident. In 1949, Geezer Butler was born, Terrence Butler, in Ashton, Birmingham, England. Bassist for none other than Black Sabbath, and possibly the coolest guy to ever come out of metal.
Wait, so he lives in St. Louis now?
Yeah, he has for decades.
Why?
Why? Yeah. I don't know. His wife hangs down at Iron Age Studios every once in a while. Or used to. I haven't talked to anyone from Iron Age in probably like 10 years.
So why is he the coolest dude to ever come out of metal?
He's just the most chill person in the world. You know, he's the antithesis to those like Norwegian black metal guys that kill each other over reputation and stuff. He's He's like the Tom Hanks of metal. If you walk up and just like, I'm the biggest fan of the world, he'll go and buy a Polaroid camera to take a selfie with you if you want one.
Weird. Yeah, but anyway, you know, that's pretty nice.
Love you, Geezer.
Let's see. Moving on to 1959. Oh, look at that. We had 1939, 1949, and 1959. So in 1959, Billie Holiday died in a New York City hospital from cirrhosis of the liver after years of alcohol abuse, which probably started at the age of 7. She died aged 43. And while under arrest for heroin possession with police officers stationed at the door to her room. In the final years of her life, she had been progressively swindled out of her earnings, and she died with 70 cents in the bank.
Mm.
Poor girl.
You know what? When she started in the industry, she sounded like she already had the voice of like a 70-year-old.
That is true.
You know, so she probably was drinking and smoking by the time she was 7.
So, for those of you who don't know who Billie Holiday is, please go out and educate yourselves. For those of you who do know, congratulations, you're one of the majority. That's all I got for that one.
All right, then.
I'm going to jump on the next one, though, because I like this one. So, 1965, King Records released Papa's Got a Brand New Bag by James Brown, which went on to sell over 2 million copies and receive the Grammy Award for Best Rhythm and Blues Recording. Papa's Got a Brand New Bag is considered seminal in the emergence of funk music as a distinct style, because James Brown was all about that percussion and using every instrument basically as a percussion instrument. Good stuff. I mean, that's one of my all-time favorite sort of funk rhythm and blues kind of songs, just because it is just perfectly put together.
Well, I'm a little upset that you stole this one from me, because you know I'm the James Brown fan here.
That is true, but I love that song.
Yes, it's a great song, and I'm looking at the list right now of musicians who are actually on it.
Yeah.
And this, that's like his one of his first ensembles, pre-Bootsy days.
Yep.
That's when James Brown started to become a household name right there.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. And well deserved for the music that he created. So, but you can do the next one.
Oh, thank you so much, sir. So on this day in 1967, Jimi Hendrix opened for what was the 8th and last time for the Monkees.
Yes. Still one of the greatest blunders of tour management ever.
Yes.
Because you think like, oh, it's Jimi Hendrix. How can you go wrong with that? Well, it was the Beatles.
Yes.
You know, it's like, you're not going to put like one of the greatest rock stars of the 60s opening for one of the greatest like pop rock bands of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It's like those two just are not going to mesh. They're just not going
to
mesh.
I liken it to like what it would be like if Skrillex opened up for like S Club 7.
Really? Wow, S Club 7?
Yeah. Like I'm trying to think of like a teeny bopper group.
Well,
recently.
Yeah, but S Club 7 is like so like that's 10 years ago, dude.
Well,
don't stop, never give up, hold your head high and reach the top.
But
I'm
here's
amazed
the thing,
that
right?
I even remembered that line right there.
No, here's my point, is that like, okay, so the Monkees were what music was at the time, and Jimi Hendrix became the influence that really changed rock and roll into the heavier genre. Right. So I'm likening it to Skrillex, which is where music is going now, mostly.
No, it would be like if Skrillex opened up for S Club 7 10 years ago.
That's exactly my point, yes.
Everybody's going to be like, what is this crap?
Yeah.
Speaking of that, I did see Skrillex 10 years ago.
Okay, then. And what was the reaction?
His band opened for another couple of bands that I really liked, which was pretty funny to me. So, because he was on tour, he was just Sonny, and he was on tour with his band. And then, like, partway through the set, he's like, who wants to listen to some electronic dance music? So he busts out his laptop and started like playing tracks off of the laptop.
Okay.
And it cracked me up. But the band that he was opening for at the time was, I believe it was a like co-headlining tour, but he was opening for the Rocket Summer, which is like one of the best pop, indie power pop groups. Like, not even a group. It's actually one dude who just records everything. But one of the greatest indie power pop acts, like, ever on earth.
Okay.
Not kidding. The music is just so good that dude creates. It was just funny. So he played before all that, and then he played a couple of EDM tracks, and nobody got it, which cracked me up. And mind you, this was at Pops across the river in good old Sauget.
Yeah, yeah.
So for those of you who don't know, Sauget is a tiny little town right next to St. Louis, and Sauget is French for classy.
Mm-hmm. Because if you've ever been to Sauget, the word that springs to mind is scenic and classy.
Yes, with the massive amount of industrial fumes and strip clubs.
Yes, right across from the strip clubs.
Yeah, right across from the strip clubs.
But hey, they have a restaurant now.
That is true. That is true. You can also bet on racehorses down there, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, at Pops or just?
No, next to Pops. There's a place next to Pops that allows you to gamble.
Oh, all right.
Like stuff like that.
Good to know.
Good to know. Either way, let's move on to also 1967. Jake, I know this was another big one. Like, and it's amazing that we lost like two great jazz artists on the same day, just separated by decades. But 1967, John Coltrane dies of liver cancer, not cirrhosis of the liver like Billie Holiday, but liver cancer at the age of 40. In addition to producing some 50 jazz session albums, Coltrane is he's a canonized saint
in the African Orthodox Church.
Wow. And he was posthumously given the Nobel Prize in 2007 and was the only non-white member of the Melody Masters, the U.S. Navy official jazz band for Pearl Harbor in late 1945.
Yes. Every time he appeared as a guest musician.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. In the Melody Masters, because there was a worry that the white officers wouldn't want a black man in the band.
Yeah.
So it was just every day. It was like, oh, and featuring Coltrane.
Nice.
Private Coltrane or whatever his rank was. I don't know.
Yeah, that's funny, though.
Yeah.
I mean, Coltrane was kind of he was a funny dude. Just like, he's got a ton of just great stories around him of like how, you know, he started out and like basically had no idea what he was doing and felt really, really bad about it. And then he like went away for a bit and came back and just played like the greatest jazz that anybody had ever heard at that time. So yeah, that's just great. Now, I will say that I am more partial to like Miles Davis, but that's just because I loved his style of composing. Yeah. And Coltrane was a little bit more like chaotic for my taste.
Yeah.
But at the same time, dude was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
So
I mean, he more or less created postmodern jazz.
Absolutely.
And experimental jazz.
Yes, definitely the experimental jazz.
And at age 40, 50 jazz albums, 50 sessions.
Yeah.
That's a ridiculous workload for that kind of age, for being that young.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway.
You want to do the next one?
Sure.
Or you want to do the last one on the day?
No, that's fine. That's fine. Let's get this out of the way.
Go ahead.
The Rolling Stones American Tour 1972. That's the official name of the tour. The Rolling Stones American Tour 1972.
That was a great naming person.
Yes, but on July 17th in 1972, it reached a fever pitch when a bomb exploded under a truck and destroyed most of the band's equipment.
I heard about this.
Yes.
I remember it, but this was in Canada, right?
Yes, in Montreal.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, to this day, it's still a mystery who planted it and why they did, but it might have something to do with later in the day when all Montreal found out that there were 3,000 forged tickets in the hands of concertgoers. And expectedly, there was a riot that ensued and the concert did not happen.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but this was Montreal.
Yes.
And in Montreal, there has always been a separatist movement.
Okay.
Because of the French Canadians that are there in Quebec.
Mm-hmm. So are you theorizing that they targeted the Rolling Stones because they're British?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because of Canada's ties to the British crown.
Maybe. Have you read anything about the 72 tour that they went on?
No.
Every single show is a scandal.
Really?
Everything ends in an arrest. I mean, band members were getting arrested and then getting bailed out by mayors because they were worried that there might be riots. I have yet to find a concise documentary on that 72 tour, but it's waiting to be made.
Nice.
So if anyone out there listening knows of a really good, concise book, because I've just pieced this together through articles, what I've read of that tour. If there's one book or just one documentary I have to read or watch, please drop me a line because I'd like to see it.
Sounds like something somebody should do. So,
absolutely.
All right, let's move on. We're actually going to jump ahead several decades.
Mm-hmm.
Go to 2004. Linda Ronstadt dedicates her encore to the new Michael Moore film called Fahrenheit 9/11 and exalts concertgoers to rush to theaters and attend a screening the next day. She then plays a cover of Desperado to boos and walkouts.
I barely remember this happening.
I don't remember this happening.
At all?
No.
Okay.
No. I don't remember it happening at all. And so that's why I was like, it's like, wow. It's like, I forgot about that Fahrenheit 9/11 was a thing.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, because Roger Moore, like, he's always just moving on to whatever the next thing is that everybody's pissed off about. So just, it's funny. Like, and let alone the fact that she would be like all about it, you know.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
Everybody needs to go watch this movie. Here we go, Desperado.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that's just a weird transition, you know.
Yes, it's
like,
it is.
If it was a song about political protest or something like that, then maybe, you know. But she's not gonna like
hey, people hitch their bandwagons to really weird causes and things that they wouldn't when they're like emotionally strung out on politics.
That is true.
But anyhow,
let's move on to July 18th, though.
Okay.
What do we got? You got this first one.
I do. 1929, Screamin' Jay Hawkins is born in Cleveland, Ohio. Known for his flamboyant and theatrical performances with a macabre theme, Hawkins carved his name in the American lexicon in 1956 with the song I Put a Spell on You.
I Put a Spell on You.
Now, I love Screamin' Jay Hawkins. Brian, I'm sure you enjoy his music. Have
Definitely.
You ever watched any of his performances?
I have seen clips of him performing I Put a Spell on You, but that's about it.
That's about it?
Yeah.
There's an appearance he did back in 56 on the Merv Griffin show where you can palpably feel the audience like worried that he's going to summon a demon on stage. And then to contrast that, in 89, he was on Arsenio Hall with Emo Phillips.
Nice.
Which, a complete dichotomy of, like, actual fear and then just pure theater.
Nice.
On Arsenio Hall. Like, you know, for being only out for a year, that Arsenio Hall show is completely ingrained in my mind. I feel like I remember almost every show, like every episode.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to 1953. Little-known truck driver Elvis Presley made his first ever recording when he paid a massive $3.98 at the Memphis Recording Service, singing two songs, My Happiness and That's When Your Heartache Begin. The vanity disc, as it was called, was a gift for his mother, and it would resurface 37 years later as part of an RCA compilation called Elvis, The Great Performances.
Mm-hmm.
So if you remember back in the day, back then,
yes,
like recording studios were like turning into these weird little places where people could go and record whatever they wanted to for like a price.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like an open studio. You come in, you pay a little bit of money, and for some reason, then they've got like musicians or, you know, like instruments there, and you can play and record whatever you want for whatever price you
have.
Right,
right.
So,
or pre-recorded music that they lay your vocals on.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So I'm fairly certain my grandpa did some of this back in the day with his country songs that he recorded. But the great thing about this was that those recordings that he did right there mm-hmm. were what actually caused him to then get picked up and signed by the Colonel, right?
Yes.
It was the Colonel, right? I'm blanking. Sam Phillips?
Yes. No, hang on.
Was it Colonel Sam? No. Sanders? Oh, my God. I'm losing it. I don't remember.
No. Sam Phillips was his producer.
Sam Phillips was the producer. That's
his
right.
His manager was we covered him like 2 weeks
yes,
ago.
Yes, we did.
I cannot remember for life of me.
Let me look here. I've got to find it. Tom Parker.
There we go.
Colonel Tom Parker. So yeah, Sam Phillips was the producer, and then Tom Parker was the other guy, was the manager. So Tom Parker, you know, they like heard him and was just like, man, this boy can really sing. We just hate these songs. Let's give him something else to do. So that's how Elvis's career got started. It's
Have you
nice.
Ever seen the, I mean, it's funny that was a studio fully staffed by people. Have you ever seen the booths?
Yeah.
Like I saw one in a museum somewhere that had, you know, recording equipment, like a booth you walk into, it's just barely big enough to stand in with a guitar around you. If you
yeah.
want. And, you know, it's wired with one microphone. And it will record and then cut a vinyl for you right there.
Yeah.
It has a vinyl cutter built into it, which is pretty wild.
Yeah. No. I mean, that stuff was pretty amazing. So just for how it all functioned back then.
And for like the longest time, like 10 years ago, YouTube was nothing but like Russian people singing karaoke to these video machines and uploading them to YouTube. I watched so many of them.
Well, you know, those Russians are pretty crazy.
I guess it's just that for that, it's just that's not a thing to me. Like if me and a bunch of guys are in a bowling alley, I'm not going to be like, hey, let's do something real gruff. Let's all go in here and stand in front of this green screen. And we're going to sing the new Zac Brown song, you know.
I will admit on a weird side note today that I watched this video clip of a guy on the Russian version of The Voice
mm-hmm.
singing Pink Floyd's the We Don't Need No Education like song or whatever. Is that The Wall?
Yeah,
The Wall.
Yeah, that's yeah. The Wall.
And he's singing that with a slide guitar that he's playing. Slide guitar sounds amazing. And yet he's singing Pink Floyd, but it he's not enunciating anything.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I have no idea what he's actually saying other than the fact that I know this song. Like,
right.
Like that's what it sounded like to me. Nothing was enunciated.
Yeah.
And yet they're like, this dude's amazing. And they all like freaking turn around. And I was just like, oh, no, people. The music was good, though. Let's move on. 1964, the Four Seasons started a 2-week run at number one on the U.S. singles chart with Ragdoll, the group's fourth number one and number two hit on the U.K. chart. Co-writer Bob Guadio said that he got the inspiration for the song from a young girl in tattered clothes that cleaned his car windows at a stoplight.
Mm.
So the reason why I put that in there, though, is because I'm actually a big fan of the Four Seasons.
Are you?
I learned how to sing harmony to the Four Seasons because the first two records I ever got were the gold records of the Four Seasons and the gold records of Elvis. First two records I ever bought. And so I used to listen to the Four Seasons, like top hits.
Yeah.
And break down each part and sing the harmony parts, you know, or the melody part. Just constantly, I'd put on headphones, and mind you, I was like 8 or 9 at the time when I did this. Like, I have distinct memories of sitting there and, like, listening to it and breaking it down and trying to sing.
Yeah, you were
the
only
parts.
Person in, like, second grade that knew every line of every song on, that played on the Golden Oldie station.
Yeah, I still am that way. Whenever they've got those, you know, Time Life Presents, the hits of the 50s. It's like they bring up, they play all these songs, and I'm just like, yep, know that one,
all
know that one, know that
of
one.
Snow White, though, he says it's pure.
I always like the early 50s ones. Like, it's mainly the latter part of the 50s and the early part of the 60s that I know, but the early 50s stuff just cracks me up because it's like actual pop hits include, how much is that doggy in the window? Arf, arf. The one with the waggly tail. It's like, really? Like, this was a hit song. That was a hit song in the 50s. What the crap? So there you go. Four Seasons, one of my all-time favorite bands from back in the day.
You know, it's really wild when you think that they went from a like, complicated kind of music like ragtime to that.
Yeah, that's true. Like, well, I mean, it became easier to market.
Yeah.
Because, like, jazz was becoming more and more complicated, mm-hmm. as evidenced by people like Coltrane and stuff, who, like, jazz music just got to be so complicated that nobody could really do it. Like, or you had to be a really skilled musician to play it. And then they started doing, like, other forms of music that people could actually sing and people could sing too. Mm-hmm. And then that sort of slowly evolved into the music of the early pop music of the 50s, which was all that sort of Doris Day kind of music.
Yeah. Well, actually that's a little unfair. Cause in the 40s, there was a lot of bubblegum pop stuff too, you know, like Boogie Bugle Boy from Company B and.
Yeah, but that also still fits in the jazz thing or the big band era.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true.
You know, so it got to a point where all that music was danceable. Big band was popular because it was danceable.
Yeah.
That was the entire reason for their existence. But jazz got to be so complicated that it turned into non-dancing music. It became just sitting and listening music. Yeah. And so there was always that thing of the balance between music that people really enjoy and music that people can dance to. We still have this dichotomy today in music because we've got, I mean, you talk about, you know, jazz, big band could dance to it. Jazz, like a lot of stuff you couldn't dance to. So then it just progresses until there's another form of music that people can dance to, i.e. rock and roll. Then in the 60s, you couldn't really dance to it.
What? You're trying to tell me that you can't dance to White Rabbit and...
You can. It's just not, like, dance music. And so then in the 70s, that created disco.
Yeah.
Disco was then counterbalanced by rock that became rock, which was the anti-disco, like, really.
Yeah, stadium rock.
Yeah, stadium rock. And then that turned into the next British invasion in the 80s, which was completely danceable because you can dance to Duran Duran. And then that countered in like the 80s as well with like a lot of punk music and stuff too, which was also kind of danceable, which was funny. And then it turned into the teenage angst stuff of the 90s with grunge.
You can dance to the Ramones. You can't dance to the Sex Pistols.
It's a bit harder to do, yeah.
Right. I mean,
there's a lot of jumping
because,
around, but there's not dancing.
No, but that's mostly because they can't play their instruments.
Mm-hmm. But that's what I'm saying is that like there's always a balance to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because then in the 90s, like what happened with pop music? You had like Aqua. And like, you know, with their song Barbie Girl, you know, it's like there's always that balance of the artistic people who are pushing the envelope and then like the record companies who are then just making music that people can dance to.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple. It's not that it's bad. It's just that it is what it is. There's always a split down the middle. Just is what it is.
Is what it is.
Let's go on to the next one. 1966. What do you got?
Yes. The Strange Death of Bobby Fuller.
I have no idea who that is.
Bobby Fuller was a musician. Okay. And his biggest hit was a cover of I Fought the Law. However, just a few months after I Fought the Law actually charted, he was found dead outside his apartment in his car covered in gasoline.
Huh.
And the official cause of death was just listed as asphyxia from gas vapors.
What they didn't put on there was that carved into the side of his car was "The Law Won."
Not so much.
No.
His brother in years afterwards has said that when he signed his death certificate, that the coroner had checkmarked both suicide and homicide and accident.
Huh.
So to this day, there's still a lot of conspiracy theories and speculation as to what happened, including the possible connection to the Manson family, which is that's just not there. It didn't happen that way.
Mm.
But no one really knows what happened to poor Bobby.
Yeah, you know, because Charlie Manson was just like, you know, that dude, that Bobby Fuller guy. I hate him. Family, go kill him. But make it look weird. That one, no.
you're talking too slow for good old Charlie Manson.
Good old
there.
Chuck.
Yeah.
Chuck Manson. Let's see. Moving on. 1974, the U.S. Justice Department ordered John Lennon out of the country by September 10th. The Immigration and Naturalization Service denied him an extension of his non-immigrant visa because of his guilty plea in England in 1968 to marijuana possession. The U.S. Court of Appeal would overturn the deportation order in 1975, and Lennon was then granted a permanent resident status the following year. He then moved back to New York, where somebody killed him.
Mm-hmm.
Good job, Justice Department. Getting people killed.
Yeah, there you
by
go.
By allowing them to live in this great country.
His death was totally foreseen, man. The Justice Department knew it. That's why they let him back in the country. They were tired of hearing his voice.
All I know is that Jared Leto shot him.
Jared Leto?
Yep, it was in that movie.
Yeah, it was.
Fat Jared Leto shot him.
You know what? He kind of does look like Jared Leto.
Well, Jared Leto actually played dude who shot him in that movie, but
yeah, no,
and
but
he put on like 60 pounds to play him.
Yeah.
So, to which
he really did look a lot like that dude's mugshot. But
like that dude really gets into his character, though. That's bad. I'm sure he didn't like actually try to plot to kill somebody when he was in that mode.
But anyway, we got a puff piece for the next story.
Yeah, this one's good. I like this one.
Yeah, 1978, Def Leppard played their very first show ever in a school in Sheffield to a crowd of 150 people. However, what school exactly they played at depends on which band member you ask.
That's great. I like that. I wonder what school it actually was. That's the funny. Because
you'd think that
like the students would remember that.
Maybe. I don't know. It's out there in the ether. You know, it's 1978, man.
How many schools could there possibly be in Sheffield?
I don't know. I don't know how big their schools are. I don't know what the population was.
I don't think Sheffield's that big.
It can't be that big, I guess, right?
I don't know. I'll find out. I'll go there and look at their history. Let's see. You know what? You can take the next one, too.
Man, another strange death. This time, Nico, the lead singer of the Velvet Underground, dies bicycling on vacation in Ibiza, Spain. That you just wanted to trip me up on that. That's why I'm reading this.
I didn't try to trip you up on it.
But anyway, at age 49, a heart attack while she was riding the bike caused her to crash and strike her head on a rock, and later died of resulting cerebral hemorrhaging.
Wow, what a way to go!
I know, right? Heart attack into blunt head trauma.
Wow, that's trippy.
Damn bicycles.
Killer of all.
Mm-hmm. I've been telling you for years, Brian.
Death
we should
traps.
All be riding tricycles.
Oh, man. All right, let's go ahead. 1991, mm-hmm. The first Lollapalooza tour begins. Band include Jane's Addiction, The Butthole Surfers, The Violent Femmes, which are actually playing in St. Louis this coming weekend. If you are listening to this show, actually during the 17th and the 21st. Fishbone, the Rollins Band, or the Henry Rollins Band, Living Color, and Nine Inch Nails.
Can I just say, Living Color does not get the credit they deserve.
Color.
Really good band.
Oh, yeah, definitely. As far as, like, these people, I mean, obviously, I like the Violent Femmes for, you know, mm-hmm. their one hit. Fishbone, obviously. Like,
right.
I'm gonna dig me some Fishbone. And Rollins Band. So, because Henry Rollins is kind of amazing. So,
you know, Jane's Addiction, they got some good songs.
Yeah, like, I've never fully gotten into Jane's Addiction. So maybe if I went back and I listened to some of their stuff, but
all the stuff that you hear played on the radio is the weird junk.
Yeah,
right. Like, and Porno for Pyros as well is kind of like an offshoot of Jane's Addiction.
Yeah,
because it's like half the band. You know, half of that band went and did that thing.
Yeah,
they've got a lot of really good. You should check out Ocean Sky. No, Open Sky.
I'll look it up.
Ocean
I'll find
Sky.
It.
Yeah, it's called Ocean Sky. Good track.
All right, we'll do.
Anyhow, this day, 1992, Billy Ray Cyrus enters the zeitgeist with Achy Breaky Heart.
Don't fill my heart, my icky breaky heart.
But they played that at Target.
Everywhere.
That song was everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yes, it was more pervasive than She Thinks My Tractor's Sexy.
Which was also another really bad country song.
Yeah, it was. That was everywhere, but man, Achy Breaky Heart. They sold Achy Breaky Heart t-shirts at departments, at like Walmart, man.
Once again, another song you can dance to.
I guess.
Because that was the entire reason, was that it had the whole like Achy Breaky Heart like line dancing thing.
Yeah.
And that was when line dancing was really starting to take off in America. Like all these clubs started popping up that were line dancing clubs. Just
Did I ever tell you about the Japanese tourist family that asked me for directions to Wild Country?
No.
Okay, so I was at Moto Mart on 157
in Collinsville, Illinois.
In Collinsville. So that, you know how close we already are to Wild Country.
Yes, yes.
As guy comes up to me and in English that he literally just looked up in a book to come and talk to me. Right. I was gassing up my truck, so he had 35 gallons worth to practice the line before he asked me. He says, "Where to Wild Country?" And I am dumbstruck that this guy is asking me where Wild Country is. And I look over at the vehicle he came from, and I can see that his wife is, well, I presume is his wife. I'm sure it was. It had to be his wife, right? She's sitting in the passenger seat of this rented Dodge Caravan with her feet up on the dashboard and cotton swabs stuck in between every toe. And she's painting her toenails. And there's two kids in the back. Both of them have Pokemon hats on, and they're playing Game Boys.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, this guy wants to see Wild Country? And it's noon.
Yeah.
It's like 12:30. Right in the afternoon. So I start to kind of tell him, like, yeah, you just take a right out of here. You go down two roads, you hang another right. And he's like, And I realize, like, this is not working. So I just say, follow me.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, huh? I go, just follow me. And he's like, oh, follow you. Yeah, follow me. I'll take you there. Okay. So I drive him over to Wild Country at 12:37 in the afternoon to an empty parking lot of a nightclub. And I wave goodbye, and he's got a big smile on his face and got out and started taking pictures.
Wow.
I assume he just wanted to take pictures to say he was at the world famous Wild Country, because that is actually broadcast nationally across the U.S.
Weird.
So there you go. Square
that.
Dancing from Collinsville, Illinois.
Oh, man.
Reaches across oceans.
Those people, there are still those people that go down there, like, and it's the same people, like, every freaking week, just because they know that they're going to end up on screen. It's weird.
Yeah.
What do we got next? Let's see. 1993, in response to the recent round of censorship laid on groups like 2 Live Crew and Rage Against the Machine, protests by standing on stage nude, with duct tape over their mouths, and PMRC, the Parents Music Resource Center, on their chests for 25 minutes in Philadelphia.
At Lollapalooza. This was a Lollapalooza tour.
Yep. It's crazy, man. People protesting for crazy stuff, but whatever.
Well, you know, okay, so we talked about before how 2 Live Crew had the first government-sanctioned censorship placed upon them.
Yes.
So that was pretty recent, the labeling of music as being dangerous in 1993. So Rage Against the Machine decided to protest in Philadelphia, and they just stood there, did not play any music for their entire set.
Mm.
So 25, I want you to think right now, Brian, about you me and just two other random people that you would have in a band, not just standing on stage for 25 minutes to not play music, but doing it nude. Gigantic set of balls on those guys.
That's all true.
I got to say.
All right, let's move on to July 19th. You can take this first one.
Oh, because you have no idea who this is.
No idea who this is.
1944, George Freya IV is born in Boise, Idaho, the lead singer and Commander Cody himself of Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen.
Nice.
Which I always have to say that slowly because those words do not seem to be in the right order.
Yeah.
His Lost Planet Airmen. But they were a country group in the 40s that were signed to, I believe it was Mercury Records, and they kind of wanted them to be a country version of the Eagles.
Yeah.
Their biggest song was something I can't remember right now.
Yeah, I don't remember either.
Yeah. However, they kind of didn't really play by the rules. And, they disbanded sometime in the 60s, played a couple reunions in the 90s. And, there you go.
All right, well, I got the next
Commander
one.
Commander Cody.
Here we go. 1954. Right. In the exact same week, just a year different, Sun Records releases the first Elvis Presley single, That's All Right, a cover of Arthur Crudup's 1946 tune, That's All Right, Mama. Only about 7,000 original copies were pressed, but the disc became a local hit in Memphis. And I've heard the song 1,000 times, obviously, because that's all right, mama. That's all right with me. So, yeah. No, I always thought that was kind of a good little first hit for Elvis to have.
Because,
you know, he loved his mama so much. He was a mama's boy. Self-professed mama's boy. And actually, when his mother died, like, that's when he really started to spiral out of control.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's just how it goes. But we can move on from there to more than a decade later, of course, with the Monkees in 1966 actually record Hey, Hey, We're the Monkees.
Yes, the theme song from the show.
Now, I'm pretty sure they didn't play on it. I'm pretty sure that it was not the actual people who or the Monkees who were playing on the recording.
Yeah, Mike Nesmith might have been in studio for it.
He might have been.
But I'm pretty sure if he was, he's the only one.
Because for those of you who do know anything about the Monkees, Mike Nesmith and Peter Tork were actually musicians and talented musicians. And then, of course, the other two, they didn't really know how to play anything. So they just kind of like, here, hold these maracas, like a bunch of them. Davy Jones and Mickey, can you play drums? Nope. Okay. Sit here with some sticks.
Hey, he learned how to count to four
He learned how to play drums specifically so they could actually play the songs.
Right.
So you can tell, like, in the early parts of recording or doing this TV show, like, he had no idea what he's doing. He had no idea how to play and sing at the same time.
Right.
And so it's like he'd be playing a little bit of stuff and all of a sudden stop and then, like, grab the microphone and you're like, but the drums are still going.
Right.
So, but yes, the Monkees, of course, record Hey, Hey, We're the Monkees, which is one of the best theme songs ever.
Okay.
Because it establishes exactly who they are from the very first line.
Right.
Hey, well, hey, we're the Monkees.
What challenge is it?
Here we come, walking down the street. Get the funniest looks from everyone we meet. Hey, hey, we're the Monkees. I love it.
Yeah.
We still need to do our review of Monkees music.
I don't know who has the writer's credit for that, but they tapped Mike really early in the process of putting the show together. And he actually did write music for it. So he
could have been in the studio. You keep talking for just 1 second.
Well, I'm going to go back to Commander Cody then.
Go ahead.
I'm going to go back to Commander Cody because you've heard one of their songs. Their biggest hit was a cover of Hot Rod Lincoln done in the 70s. And anytime you've heard Hot Rod Lincoln, it's probably the Commander Cody version. Because if you listen to the 50s version, it's clearly not the song you've been hearing for the last however many years.
Yeah. Let's see here. Well, the song for the theme, the Monkees theme, was written by Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart. And it was released as a single, obviously. But it had two different versions. And both versions had vocals by Mickey Dolenz. So.
Okay.
There you go. But yeah, it doesn't look like it's it actually had like any of the actual monkeys playing on it. But they did have a bunch of different versions that they actually ended up creating with different languages, which is kind of nice.
Oh, really? They did it in like, you know, Japanese and
Yeah, they apparently some Japanese and some Spanish versions and the German with hey hey beast do monkeys. That's great. Apparently the song was loosely based on the Dave Clark 5 song Catch Us If You Can.
Really?
Here we come again.
Mm-hmm.
Catch us if you can.
Okay, yeah.
Try to get a move on.
Kind of feel like the Dave Clark 5 song is actually better.
Catch us if you can. Catch us if you can. Yeah, I heard that song last week again.
Because
I was watching this documentary about music in like the early 60s. And they had some great footage of drummers and singers, like singers who were also drummers.
Yeah.
And so Dave Clark obviously was the drummer. And so.
Yeah. And the dude from Rare Earth.
Yes.
And Dave Grohl. Those are the three I can think of.
Well, they had a bunch of them. No, because they had the band.
Yeah.
With, oh my God, how am I forgetting his name right now? You know me. I'm so horrible with names, but it's like I can remember songs for days, but like, why am I forgetting this? It's God dang it. Levon Helm. That's right. Levon Helm, of course, playing drums and singing at the same time. So there's a bunch of them, though. All right, let's move on. What do we got next?
You give it to me.
Okay, let's see here. 1974. Oh, yes, this one. So I brought this one up just because it's a Missouri one.
Ah.
The Ozark Music Festival was held over 3 days on the Missouri State Fairgrounds in Sedalia, Missouri. One of the largest music festivals ever held. Some estimates have put the crowd number at 350,000. Acts appeared include Bachman Turner Overdrive, Blue Oyster Cult, The Eagles, America, Marshall Tucker Band, The Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, Boss Skaggs, Ted Nugent, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Electric Flag, Joe Walsh, Aerosmith, and Spirit.
Okay, so there's a couple duds in there.
Yeah, but there's a lot of good ones. See, yeah, I would have been happy with any of these. Honestly, I would have been happy to see any of these bands back in that day. So, because that was killer. I mean, that was Aerosmith back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
It was back when they were all high on drugs all the time. So, that would have been fascinating.
And, you know, Spirit, I think, is a band nobody talks about.
That's true. Not too many people talk about Spirit.
I never hear somebody go on about, like, I was at a Spirit concert in 75, and, you know.
I think it's like Air Supply. Nobody actually admits to going and seeing Air Supply.
Or Triumph. When was it? Like, Triumph has had, like, seven number one hits.
Yeah.
Nobody talks about Triumph.
Yeah, but I mean...
The other Canadian rock band from the 70s.
But even then, I mean, Ted Nugent, mm-hmm. Lynyrd Skynyrd, and Joe Walsh, like, all together. It's like... And then combine that with, like, Blue Oyster Cult and the Eagles.
You
like,
have to love a band that writes a song about Godzilla.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Have to. All right, you can do the next one.
There we go. 1989. James Brown moves cells. After Stevenson Correctional Institute officers find $40,000 in cash and checks in James Brown's cell.
So at least it wasn't like moving cells because you paused there. It's like James Brown moved cells using biochemistry.
Right.
No, we mean prison.
No, jail cell.
Jail cell.
Yes. Yes, he was in prison on charges we will get to very soon.
Yes, that is true. Mm-hmm.
But also on this day, closing out the day in 2011, Rebecca Black launches RP Records with the single My Moment.
Yeah, I still don't care.
Okay. Just checking.
Rebecca Black, of course, who famously did the horribly bad song Friday.
You know, I've heard worse.
You know, but actually, I recently watched a YouTube video on Cracked.com or Cracked on YouTube.
Yes.
And they talked all about the guy who wrote that song, who, like, that's what he does.
Yes.
He writes really bad songs.
The Vanity Press.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, for kids.
Yes.
And, like, that's it.
Yeah.
It's like, the dude's kind of evil.
I don't know, but that Friday song is—it's got to be the most. It's close to Nervous Norvis for like the. Well, Nervous Norvis wasn't really a Vanity Press; he was his own Vanity Press.
That is true.
So it's got to be the most successful Vanity Press song ever.
Yeah.
Right, because we didn't get Elvis's Vanity Press until 60 years later.
Yes, that is also true.
So there you go.
But for me, like, Rebecca Black is just one of those things of, okay, like, we need to move on from this. But
yeah.
She's still producing music as far as I know, which is even funnier. So let's move on to July 20th. I like this one a lot.
All
just
right.
Because it's sort of a weird little factoid
yes,
of history.
It is.
But 1940, Billboard's first comprehensive record chart was published. The magazine had previously published bestseller lists submitted by the individual record companies, who, of course, lied like crazy. Who were just like, yeah, this album, which, you know, originally only sold like 3,000, but, you know, this last week, it sold 30,000. It's like, okay.
Right.
It's like, but you only made like 10,000 pressings. Oh, okay. So, yeah, they used to, like, do that crap all the time.
Pre-orders.
But the new chart combined the top sellers from all major labels, and their first number one song was I'll Never Smile Again by Frank Sinatra and the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra.
Wait. It was by the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra with Frank Sinatra singing. He wasn't a name yet.
Oh, well, this is how it was listed.
Oh, so. No. It's actually a fun story. He was a very young guy who was playing vocals for the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra. I don't even know if he ever did a tour with them, because the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra was kind of like a house band at the time for a venue in New York, which I forget which venue.
Ah.
One of the opera houses or dance halls.
One of the dance halls.
Yeah.
Nice. I like that. That is good. But moving on to 1968.
Yes.
One of the greatest songs ever made.
Go for it.
1968, Iron Butterfly's second album, Inagata da Vida, entered the U.S. album charts for the first time. The album contained the 17-minute title track that filled the second side of the LP, which went on to sell over 4 million copies in the U.S. alone.
Yes.
Which is great because, of course, Inagata da Vida translates weirdly into In the Garden of Eden. And it has one of the greatest little intro. Which still cracks me up to this day on the episode of The Simpsons where I don't remember if it was Homer or if it was Bart, but they swapped out the music at church for In the Garden of Eden. And the old lady playing the organ.
Yes.
Had to, like, do it, like, for, like, the whole 17 minutes of playing the song. And at the end, Homer was like, woo!
Funny story about that. This one comes to us from Roger Connor. He told me that when that song came out, that he and his friends each put in 50 cents to pay $2 to go down to Grandpa Pigeon's.
Wow.
And at the time, at Grandpa Pigeon's, you could go and buy a 4-track. Not an 8-track, a 4-track, and put whatever music they had in their library record to that 4-track. And they went down and they put Inagata da Vida on 4 times. twice on each side of the 4-track.
Wow. That's crazy. Why would anybody do
or
that?
Actually, I take that back. It might have only fit on twice because it's 17 minutes. It might have had 2 copies of it because they wanted to play it nonstop, buddy. It's nonstop rocking. In this Chevy Nova, it's a nonstop rock fest.
All right. So the next one.
Yes.
I know is not music related.
Not exactly.
But it inspired music.
Yes, it did.
After the fact and before the fact.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
1969.
A good year.
We landed on the moon.
The moon, people.
And when I say we, I mean...
the United States.
The United States and humanity itself.
That's one small step for a man. One giant leap for mankind.
Hey, he's walking onto the fucking moon, man. Give him a break. So he screwed up the line.
He didn't screw up the line.
Yeah.
No, he didn't screw up the line.
That's
it was,
what
it
NASA
was a glitch.
Says. He screwed up.
It was a glitch
up.
In the audio.
Look, the guy's walking onto the damn moon.
Yeah.
He can screw it. We don't need to cover for Neil. He's not Daniel Day-Lewis. He's not the actor incarnate delivering
lines. I'm just saying, like, according to them, it was an audio glitch.
Mm-hmm. Listen, this is the only moon landing
conspiracy.
So it's
like he didn't say a man. He said like, you know, that's one small step for a man. It's like, but because of the weird where the audio glitched, it sounded like he said that's one small step for man.
I'm not buying that at all. He messed it up.
I know how audio stuff works like that, and I know that it could have very easily happened that way. So I mean, it's like. So what, I mean, it's not like he actually had, like, the line, like, it wasn't like a NASA thing. I mean, he just came up with that. Like
I think somebody wrote it for him.
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure somebody wrote it for him. Mm. You can't just let somebody, like...
Fine, then. Here, you want to go for some weird trivia, then? What was the first thing eaten on the moon? They landed, they ate something. What was it?
Tang.
No. Communion.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He had a little thing of wine. And
the
he had
body
a
of Christ.
The body
oh,
of
God.
Christ.
All right. Ooh.
I'm just saying, you know, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, they had communion because Buzz was devoutly religious.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, I feel that this is important enough for us to do this. And so they did
it. Yeah. Well, I mean, okay, if you want to get in trivia, then I'm sure the first thing that was said on the moon was,
the moon!
You good, Buzz?
Yeah. Did you ever see the thing of Neil Armstrong? Like, it was like a fake video, or I mean, it was like a sketch mm-hmm. comedy thing of Neil Armstrong later on in life, and it shows him, and he like you know wakes up in the middle of the night, and he's just like the moon, and then it shows him like having sex with his wife, and at the very end, you know, like instead of calling out her name, he calls out the moon.
No, I haven't. But that's the moon.
Like, I mean. He was the first human being to ever set foot on the moon.
Yes.
And they're like, all right, you've got bragging rights forever. Like, nobody else could even come close to that.
No.
So, man. Now, I'm a huge fan of that era of space exploration. I've seen, like, so many documentaries about mm-hmm. the moon landing and... the entire process from when Kennedy was basically like, you know, yep, mm-hmm. we're going to go to the moon by the end of the decade. And NASA was just like, he said, what? Like, oh, good God. How are we going to do that? Like, I know the entire
clearly,
process. Like,
we're going to doctor the Gemini pictures and then pay Soderbergh to come in and direct a film on a soundstage in Houston, Texas, where some guy, while they were filming, opened a door that caused the flag to flap and because they're just such clumsy bastards.
Yes. So, but as we said beforehand, this, of course, inspired a lot of music.
Yes.
Maybe not even, like, directly,
mm-hmm.
but what it... Because, I mean, there's a ton of songs about the moon, but there's always been a ton of songs about the moon. But there, it was one of those things of, like, it was such a pivotal moment in mm-hmm. humanity that it couldn't help but sort of shift how people viewed, like, everything.
Yeah.
It's like, because mankind had set foot on another body in the universe. So, you know, it really did affect, like... how artists created things and how music was then done. It's kind of a fascinating process. Not to mention all the technological advancements that were developed just for all of that stuff. And then, of course, that translated over into the civilian population and advancement in a lot of other technologies, including the stuff that we use today to edit our audio. So, I mean, it is a... a transition point in history, and that's a very good thing. But what do we got next?
Oh, here we go. This is my pick for the week.
Yeah, go ahead.
The year, 1983. The location, London, England. Princess Diana and Prince Charles are attending their first Duran Duran concert when Sean O'Callaghan chickens out and becomes an informant for a bomb plot to blow up the Royals.
Wait, who? Sean O'Callaghan?
Sean O'Callaghan, a man you've never heard of. He was a member of the IRA, was in the bomb plot, was supposed to set up a bomb, and instead walked into a police station, handed them the bomb, and told them where the other locations were.
Wow. See, I thought like maybe you were going to say like a member of Duran Duran was going to try and kill him or something.
No, but I love where you're going with that, and it would make an excellent episode of Quantum Leap.
That is true. Mm-hmm. That is true.
Oh, boy.
Surprisingly, in the office today, we were actually going through some great conspiracy theories, but mainly the JFK assassination.
Oh, Jesus.
Because a bunch of the kids, the interns that are there, had no idea what actually happened. They just knew that Kennedy was assassinated, but they had no idea about Oswald. They had no idea about the shots. They had never heard of the magic bullet theory. Like, any of that stuff. And so like we got to sit there and actually explain to these kids like, well, this is what it's believed to have happened. This is what footage shows us. It was very funny just because we had like maybe a 30-45 minute conversation about everything involving the JFK assassination.
And then you immediately went to the authority on the subject, Jesse the Body Ventura's website.
No, we did not. But that was just a funny little bit in the office today. Let's see. What do we got next? 1991, EMF went to number one on the U.S. singles chart with You're Unbelievable.
Oh!
It spent 14 weeks on the charts before reaching number one. But, man, what a great little pump-up kind of song. They still play that at, like, hockey games and stuff, too, so... It's that, oh, man. It's like, it's such a great little catchphrase. Yeah. You're like, it's unbelievable. Oh!
If you remember, that was, I mean, I think like 93 was when the Gary Glitter thing kind of came out. About him, in his trial for being a pedophile. There's no real kind way to say that, though, is there? So, I don't know. Hey, maybe everyone was like, we got to stop playing this Gary Glitter song in theaters or in auditoriums. What else we got? How about this EMF thing? Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. So, I know there's that one, and then there's that, you know, woohoo!
Blur.
Blur, yeah, that's right.
Which there's sounds that, and nothing then, like and then, anything else.
Then
did.
Of course, Queen, "We Will Rock You."
Yeah, so,
there's too many songs that they play like that are like just anthem rock.
Yeah.
All right, so what do we got for 2012? We're jumping
all the way
ahead
up to 2012. Skrillex sits at number one for the opening of the Billboard Social 50, a new chart that uses social media to measure a digital audience.
Interesting.
Digital.
I like that, though. I mean, I don't really care for Skrillex, obviously, but that is nice that at
obviously.
Least there's, you know, like creating a new chart. Yeah. That's good. I like it.
Yeah, so we're only 5 years into, like, Billboard actually talking about social media and looking at clicks and...
Yeah. Now let's move on here. July 21st,
the last day
of our week. 1947, we've talked about this man before. Some of it was bad, like, but we're going to be happy here because it was his birthday, in 1947, born on this day, Cat Stevens, of course, singer, songwriter, had a ton of hits that were just great sort of, I wouldn't say folk hits, but just like that acoustic, you know, nice mellow kind of like almost protesting music, but not quite protesting music. I don't exactly know how to
describe
it.
It's like protest music, but without the substance.
Oh, man. But I don't care. It's like the fact that he wrote like The Wind.
Yeah.
Is one of my all-time favorite songs. I listen to the wind, through the wind of my soul. Seriously, I love that song.
Yeah.
So... Now, of course, the only reason why I know about that song was due to Wes Anderson and the Rushmore soundtrack.
Great soundtrack. We've already talked about
The Rushmore soundtrack because that was such a good one. But yeah, no, I'm Cat Stevens, now Yousef Islam, produced a ton of really good music. Mm-hmm. And he's still producing music. It's a little bit tinged, but at the same time, it's still good music. I just don't listen to it all the time, but good on you, Cat Stevens, for producing one of my favorite songs. Let's see, what do we got next? Oh, 1973, Jim Croce started a two-week run at number one on the U.S. singles charts with Bad, Bad Leroy Brown. Croce was unfortunately killed in a plane crash 3 months later.
Yeah, yeah.
Leroy Brown was not a suspect.
Shame on you.
Just saying.
Well, all right then.
But Bad, Bad Leroy Brown has become one of those songs that like everybody knows kind of, and is like in movies, it is the one song that is generally done like during a karaoke scene.
Okay.
Up on stage, there's somebody singing Bad, Bad Leroy Brown. I swear.
It's like almost impossible to sing the song poorly.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that it's not a good melody. I'm just saying, like, you can throw key out the window and sing whatever notes you want.
Yeah.
And no one's going to call you on it.
So there's Bad, Bad Leroy Brown. And then I also remember there's another song that was You Don't Mess Around With Jim. You don't tug on Superman's cape. You don't speed into the wind. You don't pull the mask off the old Lone Ranger, and you don't mess around with Jim.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, like, those are the two songs that I always remember of, like, that are about somebody, you know, being really bad.
Yes. My personal favorite is Big Bad John.
Oh, that's right. Big Bad John. I remember that one, too.
Yeah, not a Jim Croce song. Just
No.
A song about somebody who's badass.
And then to kind of dovetail that one together, what's the Come a Little Bit Closer?
Come a Little Bit Closer?
Come a little bit closer, you're my kind of man.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Because the entire song is like this girl who's dating that bad man, Jose.
Yeah, although we're forgetting Tennessee Ernie Ford.
Yeah, that's
16 tons. One fist of iron, the other of steel. If the right one don't get you, then
16
the left one
tons.
Will.
What do you get? Another day.
Maybe
older,
all right. I take it back.
Debt.
Maybe it's not so much a song about being badass, but it's got a good line in it.
All righty, what do we got?
Jim Croce. We're forgetting Time in a Bottle.
Oh yeah, that's true. That is true. But I know we got another one, and you brought this up earlier.
I teased, yes.
You teased it.
Mm-hmm. Now it's time to please. To deliver. Yes, 1988. Jim Brown pleads guilty on assault.
James Brown, mind you. You said Jim Brown.
Jim Croce.
James Brown.
Yeah, Jim Brown is not a convicted felon. He's actually a really nice guy. Damn it. All right, so James Brown pleads guilty on assault, gun charges, resisting arrest, assaulting an officer, multiple driving offenses, and some drug possession, which is later expunged, in Aiken Court, South Carolina, sentenced to 6 years, but only served two.
Yeah.
Now, I'm cheating a little bit on this because on this day, July 21st, there were four different incidents that happened in 87 through 88 that he all ended up pleading guilty to. This was only one round of it, which involved the resisting arrest, the crazy driving charges, police chase, and him assaulting an officer. However, he was also convicted of domestic assault and a whole bunch of other things. Yeah, pretty tumultuous time in James Brown life. And for whatever reason, I've always given him a slide on all of those.
Yeah, well, we tend to give a lot of artists.
He's the godfather of soul, man.
I mean, like, as long as they don't do anything like truly, truly bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, beating his wife. I mean, that's kind of,
you know, like maybe, like if he was a pedophile, then you know maybe we could. Like, I mean, that would be pretty bad. That'd be pretty bad.
You've never held Gary Glitter's feet to the fire on that, Brian. I'm just gonna say.
I don't even really know who he is.
Gary Glitter?
Sorry. Yeah.
He did Rock and Roll Parts 1 and 2.
Oh yeah.
Ba-na-na-na-na-na-na. Hey! Ba-na-na. No. Rock and roll.
They still play that one, though.
Yeah, they do.
That's the...
But that's that guy. Yeah. Anyway, he's British.
Yeah. So, let's see here.
Let's go back a year.
I must have misplaced that one.
That's all right.
1987, Guns N' Roses released their debut album on Geffen Records, Appetite for Destruction, and featured the singles Welcome to the Jungle, Sweet Child of Mine, and Paradise City, which I always thought for some reason was the very last city.
The very last city?
Yeah, I always thought, like, when I was younger, like, it was take me down to the very last city with...
So it's like a post-apocalyptic
song? Yeah, that's what I always thought.
About it's the only place that has, like, pretty girls and green grass?
Yeah, I thought it was like some weird little post-apocalyptic, and then I found out what it actually was, and
You're giving them way too much credit.
Wow, that's actually pretty... That's a lot
that's
different.
That's kind of dumb, yeah.
I like my version better.
I like your version better, too.
The post-apocalyptic version, where there's like an oasis of green stuff and pretty women.
Remember, Decker, everyone dies. Not everyone really lives. And if you ever make it to the very last city, lay on the green grass for me.
Which then, you know, like with Appetite for Destruction, if you look at it then, the entire album is a concept album. Welcome to the Jungle, obviously, right, the protagonist, you know, fighting his way through the vicious wildlands.
I quit. We're never going to top this.
Sweet Child of Mine is obviously a connection to the protagonist's child, mm-hmm. whom he's trying to get to, who he sent away to Paradise City a while ago.
Right, of course.
And so he's been fighting his way across the wastelands to get there. There you go. You see, you just don't give Guns N' Roses enough credit.
Yeah.
So there you go. I totally am going to put this as the title. Guns N' Roses.
Concept.
Appetite for Destruction. It's like, what's Appetite for Destruction? A concept album about the post-apocalyptic society? Question mark. Oh, man. So, but the album had worldwide sales in excess of 28 million, but 18 million of which were in the U.S., making it the best-selling album of all time here, which is not true, actually. I don't know why they put that in there as like a mm-hmm. little fact.
I don't know why you typed that out like it's a little fact.
I didn't type it out. I just sort of copied it over.
Oh, there you go.
Because I was like, oh, yeah, that's pretty good. And I must have taken like the entire sentence and I didn't read all of it.
Anyway.
But, it's definitely not, like the best-selling album in America, I know that much, because there's tons of stuff that beats it, but, I mean, like, Thriller smoked that, so.
Yes.
But either way, we are looking forward, because Guns N' Roses is coming back to St. Louis after the infamous
yes.
St. Louis riot that happened at the Guns N' Roses show, and so a lot of people are wondering if they're going to bring it up at the show. Because Axl Rose famously said, I will never play in that town again.
Unless they have a check, right? It's like George Jefferson, I'll never do that unless they got a check.
So there you go. It's one of those things of, we'll find out. I should be going to that show. So I'm looking forward to possibility.
Well, let's hope that your concert review for that show is positive.
I haven't done a concert review in a while, too, which is kind of bad. I've been seeing a couple of shows. Like, I went and saw U2 in Toronto. I never did a review of that one. So, but I'll do a review of U2 when they come to St. Louis.
All right.
And then some other stuff. And I might be going to something maybe this weekend. Or if not, I believe Warped Tour is coming through next week.
Yes.
So I'm going to go to that one if I can. It's on a Wednesday, so I might have to, you know, finagle it a bit. But there's a couple of bands I definitely wanted to see. All right, so.
Here we go.
Okay,
We got two left. I know which one you want to do first.
Well, this one I definitely want to do.
Go for it, then.
1989, the movie UHF opened in theaters. And a lot of people didn't go see it.
To a very mild reception. However.
Well, considering that at that same week, like, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids came out. Like, of course, mm-hmm. nobody was going to go see UHF. You're like, do you want to go see Rick Moranis as a lovable inventor who invents a shrink ray and his kids have to go through an adventure through the backyard as microscopic beings?
No.
Yeah, let's see that.
I want to go see a film that stars Weird Al Yankovic and uses a Twinkie Wiener sandwich as a plot device.
Exactly. But either way, UHF is one of my all-time favorite mm-hmm. comedies.
Give us the plot synopsis.
So what it
as
is...
As if
is
it a, matters.
So Weird Al plays this yes. young guy who has basically nothing has ever really gone right for him in his entire life. He's been fired from every job that he's ever had because of his wild imagination that just gets him into trouble. And his uncle wins a UHF station in a poker game and decides to give it to Weird Al so he can run it and, you know, basically do whatever he wants with it. And he takes this station that basically played nothing but reruns mm-hmm. of just old crappy stuff like Mr. Ed and then turned it around with some new programming and some new shows and all of that with a good weird cast of characters and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, for those that don't know, back in the day when television was not digital but an analog, UHF stood for ultra high frequency. There were two bandwidths, VHF and UHF. And usually the UHF channels were of lower budget, lower quality, and smaller.
Yes. So I know in our region, we had in VHF, we had channels 2, 4, mm-hmm. 5, 9, and 11.
Yes.
And then in UHF, we had channel 30 and channel 46.
Yes.
This is what we had for television in the St. Louis area.
You are
and for- channel 46
yes.
Was, it's still around somewhere. I don't even remember what 46 did as far as their programming. But the, oh, okay. And then oh, we did have one other channel. We had channel 24.
Yes.
Which
Larry
was
Rice.
Larry Rice, and they had a bunch of weird mix of Christian programming and weird reruns.
Yes.
So, but yes, UHF stood for ultra high frequency, and it was generally the, like, I hate to say it was like the AM radio of of television, because, you know, I really like the AM radio stuff that's in St. Louis.
It
but
sort of does a disservice to AM radio. So
yes,
that, yeah.
But UHF was just this really goofy, like, just... The TV stations just had really bad programming for the most part, except for Channel 30.
Access.
Channel 30 here in St. Louis was actually really good.
But
so.
That was only after it was a Fox affiliate.
That was
before
yes.
it was a Fox affiliate.
Yeah,
it was also public access.
Yes,
there's also a public access channel that came out of St. Charles. I don't remember what the dial number was.
Yeah, I don't remember either.
Yeah, but anyway.
But I would, on another side note, though, here in St. Louis, though, we had Channel 11. Channel 11 was an independently owned TV mm-hmm. station, and it is because of Channel 11 that anybody in America knows what Voltron is.
Okay,
because
yes.
Channel 11
yes.
was the first station to ever broadcast Voltron and turn it into a huge thing. And actually, the company that owned Channel 11, like, made a massive amount of money off of, like, the marketing and toys and, like, that kind of stuff off of Voltron. And they were responsible for the Netflix revival as well.
There you go. So take that,
but
anyone.
UHF with Weird Al, mm-hmm. of course, Weird Al being the music person that he is, there was some good music in there, including... the I Want My MTV,
yes.
You know, Beverly Hillbillies
Dire
parody.
Dire Straits parody.
Dire
yeah.
Straits parody, which was just great because it was this whole, like, they filmed it just like the Dire Straits
yeah,
video.
Yeah. That old Jay was shooting. He was shooting at some food. Yeah. But yeah, so the plot really breaks down at about like the 24-minute mark when they just go into what becomes like a sketch comedy show of Weird Al presenting the programming for the channel, which includes sketches like Conan the Librarian
mm-hmm.
and commercials for a warehouse department store that only sold spatulas called Spatula City.
I still love Spatula City. That's great. And Crazy Ernie.
Yes.
Crazy Ernie's cars. Car
Crazy
sales.
Ernie's car
He's like,
sales,
if you
yes.
don't, if somebody doesn't come down and buy a new car in the next 30 minutes, I'm going to club this baby sale.
Yeah.
and you see the seal, and it's just like, yeah, UHF to me, though, is hilarious because of its absurdity. So if you get a chance, check out UHF if you haven't seen it. But for those of you who are closer to our age, you probably have seen it if you are any kind of cool person. I'm just saying. But
our last
story. Close out the
also list. 1989. While UHF is premiering, Milli Vanilli takes the stage, and girl, you know it's 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 girl. You can stop me anytime, man.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to stop. I mean, because that's exactly what happened.
Yes.
And Milli Vanilli, of course. Bombed after that because they had to admit that they weren't actually
the voices
singing.
Yes, for those that don't know, Milli Vanilli won a Grammy for their album featuring the single Girl You Know It's True and also the hit Blame It on the Rain. However, after the cassette tape that they were using to sing to skipped, who uses magnetic tape? Was that more reliable than a record?
I don't know. All I know is that it started a whole thing of, you know, this was like the first time that an artist had really been like busted for lip syncing to tracks like and stuff or, to music that was being played. Now, I know on some TV stations like in the UK and stuff, you know, for the shows that they had. They would play the single anyway, and the people would lip sync to it. But that wasn't the case.
No,
of that.
this was like a group
that like it was supposed to be an absolutely like live performance, and then it just completely fell apart after that.
Right,
because then everybody found out that they weren't actually singing, and then of course like ever since then, anytime somebody has ever tried to do it and failed, they've been slammed for the exact same thing.
Which really is kind of unfair because Milli Vanilli was a constructed group built by a recording label who decided that the frontmen would be models.
Yeah, because the band sounded good. They loved the music, but none of the members of the band looked good. And so they picked two different male models to be the lead frontmen.
Right. Not dancers, not musicians. Models.
Yes.
Yes, and then rather than pay the group to tour and sing behind stage, they just ran the tape.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a really big deal. It was a bigger deal, and the two guys, Milli and Vanilli, got more flack than they should have. The flack really should have gone to
the record label.
Yeah, onto the label.
Yeah, completely agree. But is what it is, and Milli Vanilli, you know, one of the members tragically killed himself, so there was that. But, you know, that's kind of a downer thing to end on.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I mean, this stuff happens. But thank you very much for listening to Follow the Sound. It has been a blast so far, and, you know, we're going to continue doing these types of shows because we love doing the music history episodes. But if you want to check out some of the other great programming on lineupmedia.fm, you can go to exactly that, lineupmedia.fm, and click on any of the great shows that we have listed. Go ahead and check out some podcasts like Next Gen Nerds, which of course features my brother. He's been on the show before. You know, some other great ones like Surreal Talk if you're into those conspiracy theories, because Lord knows we are. But if you want to help out the show, you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com and click on the Amazon banner, or go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Do all of your normal shopping. We get a little bit of money back, and it is just that simple. But thank you once again for listening. I have been your host, Brian Kroc, and along with me has been Jacob Crum.
Put down your remote control. Throw away your TV guide. Don't put on your jacket. There's no need to go outside. We've got it all on UHF.
Remember, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.